Alrighty, welcome to the Offense Security Podcast. I'm your host, TJ Nall, and I also like to bring in our co-host, Harbinger, as well, too, as we have a very special guest for this episode that we have. For today's episode, we have an awesome guest, and they're a good friend of mine. Today, I'd like to welcome Joe, also known as the Blind Hacker, to the OffSec Podcast. It's great to have you here, Blind.
It's good to be here.
So, Blind, I've known you for a long time, but for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
That's always such a loaded question, because I do so much and do a lot. I feel like ultimately, though, I am I'm just a hacker. A hacker that has built communities, built tools, built things. But my real claim to fame is actually being visually impaired and talking about it with a lot of the other hackers and kind of being an advocate for those that have disabilities and are differently abled within our community. And, and then a bunch of other cool stuff on top of that.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. I always love hearing about the stuff you do and, you know, the stories that we go ahead and talk about, even through the challenges that you have been through. But, you know, I know you've overcome a lot of those challenges, especially getting into this field, you know, and also obtaining your OCP. Can you talk about some of the challenges you have faced, you know, just to get to where you are now?
Easy. I'm going to kind of go back to the wee beginning, the wee little hacker in me. You know, I definitely was one of these early, late 90s, early 00s kind of hackers. I really liked computers. I liked messing with them. I liked breaking them. I liked figuring all the ins and outs. And it wasn't just one of those things where I just doxed a few friends or whatever. No, I wrote a couple components. I learned a few things. And then when I was 16, that's when I started losing my vision. And it became more apparent that I was going to be spending more time on a computer because that's the way the world was going, technology was going, and the benefit was is they were accessible. And then so, of course, hacking accessibility into computers kind of became my first thing because back in the early days, the Windows magnifier, things like that didn't work too great. And a lot of issues. And I still love building machines and doing things. So as I got through high school, there's some other fun stuff that happened there. But a lot of learning, ultimately, a lot of growth. Well, what happened was when I was about shortly before I turned 18, I went to a university that specialized in dealing with students with disabilities. And I was trying to get in on their program to help students with disabilities get like certifications in education for IT. Well, after being there for a while, for a week, I went in for an assessment and there was a educator there who told me I'd never make it in this industry. And I took it to heart. And from young 17-year-old me to all the way about 20, I didn't think I was going to make it in this industry. I was trying any other jobs, anything that would allow a blind person to, a visually impaired blind person, the ability to at least, you know, take care of themselves. And, you know, that included being, you know, trying to do retail stuff, stocking, and then all the way to being a plumber's helper, because I couldn't do all the other stuff, soldering, like, you know, I can install faucets, things like that. It's all a lot of touch and tactileness. And then finally I said, no, I'm not passionate about this. I'm really passionate about computers. Mm-hmm. So I took a chance and started applying for computer jobs. And finally someone gave me the chance, and kind of the rest is on that resume. You know, if you sit down and you have a talk with me, be glad to talk about everything that happens through there. But the ultimate outcome is here I am, a pretty well-known figure in the community. Again, not just for being the blind hacker, but for being, you know, the handle of the blind hacker, clearly, but for being someone who has done some things and educated a lot of people, because, again, I was told that I'd never make it in this industry. And I kind of don't want anybody to ever be told that.
Yeah, I can certainly agree with that, man. And especially with, you know, a lot of the people that put you down or told you cannot be able to do that. And now you can be able to tell those people, well, if you ever do see those people in your face, you know, that I proved them wrong, right?
Oh, you know? I wish if I could remember that educator's name, I would definitely love to give them a call and be like, hey, check out this, you know, this resume and tell me again. And I kind of, part of me also wonders, like, how long was that educator in charge? How many other students who could be doing what I'm doing ultimately aren't, and they didn't follow their passion, or maybe they gave up on it.
So I am kind of curious though, when you were trying to get into IT and cyber, with the challenges that you've gone through, what made you also go through the OSCP?
I was so scared of it for such a long time, actually. It's funny because it's only been in the more recent few years, and I've been doing what we'll call it cyber and infosec for since 2008, right? Like that was my first. I had a job at a as a systems security engineer with systems engineer with security experience installing IDS, IPSs, and stuff on local systems. A bunch of random toolage that was brought to the contract, and then I configured it, managed, maintain it, set up a defense in depth strategy, all kinds of like cool old terms, and then and then I was like, I really like doing this, and then I found out that the oh, like I could get paid to like actually like break into these systems. So then it was just this weird transition, and then the OSCP was around back then, and I was like, I just saw these like heroes. I'm calling them heroes to me as this young pen tester, as this all this as these young hackers, this young infosec enthusiast, going, oh man, that guy has an OSCP, this that, and when I go to conferences, I just hear them go, oh gosh, how hard this thing was, how difficult this thing was, and you're like, I'm like. Is it really that hard? Is it really difficult? So then finally, like I get like to the point where I've got 10 years of experience in the field and I'm like, all right, it's time. And then I get to study material and I'm like, this is old. Like I know all of this because I've been doing it, but like I haven't done some of this stuff in a few years. And so let's be clear. I took the older OSCP, not the modern day version. I have paid the upgrade fee, and the material is significantly better. Teaches you a lot more categories, which is like, oh man, this stuff is great. So then when I took it, I was like, man, that was a little bit easier than I thought it was. But I went for it because to me, that was the challenge. That was the Like that was like this, and at the same time, it's kind of an entry level pen testing cert because it kind of just says, oh yeah, you can do this stuff. But it was that challenge, right? It's not like the other certifications where it's like, okay, you can read, do some stuff, go take an exam and probably pass. This isn't just a cert. It's a challenge. To me, it still really means something to say, hey, I have this because it was hard, not because I studied really hard, but because I studied, worked in a list. I feel like I put a lot of my life into it. The 90 days, I put a thing together. And then when I got done, that's when you and I started talking more, TJ. And I was like, so here's all the things I did. You're like, what? You're asking me about links and blogs and like all the other stuff that I was like, I dude, I was like, I just had this whole resource and boom, I posted it to my community. I posted it to a couple other places. That's what I started streaming. I was streaming kind of my post path of OSCP, like, oh, I've already graduated, I've already got the cert, like let me try to share my knowledge. And then that's what kind of built my persona up in the community was like, hey, like I did this really hard thing and I was successful at it and here's my recipe for it and kind of handing out that recipe wherever I could.
Joe, you said something that I want to stick on for a second. You mentioned this concept of entry-level pen testing. One of the things that we often, struggle with is this concept that people want to get into the field and they want to start pen testing right away.
Oh.
Having been through the gauntlet, how do you feel about that, looking at like the modern landscape right now?
I really do try to sit down with anybody who comes my way and says, I'm an infosec newbie and I want a pen test. And I'm like, well, we're gonna need to talk because it's a larger conversation than like, say, I've made the decision I want to be an infosec and then I need to pen test tomorrow. Well, that's a difficult thing because I, as a, now professionally, like I said, so a lot of us came through this other doorway. Like I actually ended up having to get a CISSP and go to be an ISO, do compliance work. And then finally I was trusted to be a pen tester. And it was this, it, like, that's the way I saw everybody else doing it. Everybody else that I saw was becoming a pen tester and getting the hack all day had that very similar path. Well, nowadays, the good thing is you don't have to do that. But ultimately, pen testing still, and I say this, and a lot of people's like, oh, it's gatekeeping, this and that. But I'm telling you, no, if I can't trust you day one to know what a TCP packet and a UDP packet, if you don't have networking, if you don't have basic fundamentals of the word compliance, database, like I need you to know the jargon. I need you to know how those things work. Because if I put you in a client and say they have an ICS platform, a control systems platform, and you send a bunch of UDP packets and you turn around this device defaults open and then floods a city, that's not good, right? And so when I'm talking to people about entry-level pen testing, I mean entry-level pen testing, not entry-level to InfoSec, where I need you to have a little bit of these other terms. I'll be glad to grab anybody with no experience and be like, hey, I need someone who's going to kind of run Nessus, who's going to do some recon, OSINT, Nmap, use tools like AMAS, auto recon, like go hit the external, go do those things, go bring me as the experienced person the bad stuff, and don't execute anything that we could be dangerous. And I talk about that a lot on my streams and other podcasts, like that. And that's an important thing, because there are things that are very dangerous. Now we're starting to even like notice like RDP and like, you know, like a public facing RDP. Well, you, me, a TJ, we know that's bad. Day one entry people like, oh man, I just need to access the system. Even security people, like, let me just poke a hole through the firewall. Let me access my system via RDP. Well, the intrinsic value of having vulnerabilities there is terrible. Like, don't do that. Like, reverse proxy and all these other technologies. Again, if you don't know those technologies, I can't reasonably, now a senior in my career, director level, management level, I can't hire you if you don't know that that's bad. Well, how do you learn that that's bad? That's experience. So and like I said, it's one of those things like, how do I help people? Well, usually thing number one, if somebody comes to me and says, I want to learn to hack, you know, and it's somebody serious, right? Not just like, you know, hack my Facebook, blah, blah, blah. No, when somebody comes to me and says, I really want to learn to be an InfoSec, I want to learn to be a pen tester. Usually thing one, two, and three I send them is kind of ultimately Kali.training, because like, hey, this is probably the OS you're going to use. I don't care if you use Parrot, but use Kali. It works. I like it a little better personally. And that's actually, we'll discuss that here in a little bit, I'm sure. But I like it because it has accessibility. It has things that work for me as an individual. I also send them still to Metasploit Unleashed. It's a little bit older. I tell them, you know, and then I go, hey, here's Hack the Box, Phone Hub, try and hack me. And then, you know, and then I'll come back to them and say, okay, like, so what do you know right now? After I send you all these links, what do you know right now? Nothing. And I'm like, everything I said is now useless because you don't know how to use a tool. You don't know these things. So let's go look up videos. Here's some of my old videos or other people's videos for recon. Like, there's a methodology, and building a methodology is step number one of being an entry-level pen tester. You got to know not just P-test, not the ethical hacker method, not the OSCP method, not the OFSEC method. You got to at least just know that there are certain steps you have to take to do this. I don't care whose methodology it is. You just need to know something, and then you refine it. And that's when you start to show me maturity, becoming a mid-level. You have your methodology. Now you're not defaulting, you know, water pump units to open, flooding cities. Now you're not doing these things. You're a little bit more careful. I remember being a young pen tester and just hail marrying from Armitage and like, yeah, we're getting shells. Like, oh my God, now a few, you know, here it is, decade later, I'm like, I wonder how much stuff I broke. How many printers were just like emptying the inkjet cartridges? Oh man.
Definitely a lot of good old stories that you've had back in the day, especially, you know, getting to where you are in your journey as well. I mean,
yeah,
you know, just from what it sounds like, you know, even going through, you know, your pen test experience, going through the OSCP itself, you know, getting your OSCP, you've overcome a lot of challenges, especially, you know, having more challenges than a lot of other normal people will have as well. So, after, you know, you getting your OSCP, you doing what you're doing now, like, are there still any current challenges that you're facing now that you are having like a hard time with, or like, you know, is it something in the InfoSec community that, you know, you think should be able to improve, you know, for your side, you know, with your disability and also for other people that may have disabilities as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the challenges I face just day to day, right, is context and understanding of tools, meaning when people release a new tool, I love it. Like, you know, so I've got a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge seeing tools, but when people come to me and say, hey, here's this brand new tool, it's doing a thing. And I'm like, okay, cool. And for the most part, I go, I can understand the thing. So most of my challenges stem from people who kind of don't tell me exactly what their tool may or may not be doing. Like, and it's not very well documented. Like I can read, again, through experience and time, I can read almost every language out there, a programming language, not, you know, written language, spoken language. But I can read almost every programming language out there, again, as long as it's based on English, realistically. I can go, that's doing a thing. Here's the math. Here's an if, then, or these things. Like, go, okay. But the challenges I see is, how do I teach this to somebody coming on board? So my challenge now is, as I've shifted from my knowledge and when I'm trying to share my knowledge, is how can I teach this other person these things? So that's step one. That's the big problem I run into a lot. So it's mostly me spending a lot of time trying to figure out those things. Challenge number two. I went to the Bloodhound Gang, group, the Bloodhound Gang, as it were, and I said, guys, I love Bloodhound. I love it as a tool. It works well. But if I were totally blind, or even when I get networks that have thousands of nodes and units back to me, and I try to navigate this giant CF, this immutable, ununderstandable, unintelligible lines and dots, and I go, how do I do this? They came back immediately and they were like, oh, actually, we kind of have a tool that can bring it up in command line. I'm like, perfect. Like, you know, that's challenge number two, is making sure when you produce tools, is there a command line capability? Can someone else write a parser for it? If you're not willing to write a parser, bad on you, in my opinion, but it's okay. Because if you put it out in an output or document your work, I will try to write the parser for it. Some things that projects that I've done that haven't been released, like things like I use a tool that I call Watchdog, which everybody has a tool named it, but I don't know why I named it that. I was just, you know, naming tools one day. But all it does is parses Nmap for me. So when I do a like VVV, very, very verbose, you know, giant scan across a giant network, and I get to use my tool and say, Watchdog, bring me everything with SMBV1. And it's going to go out, read every file, grep through it and go, here's the 7 IP addresses with SMBV1. And then inside of that, it'll print a file and go, I'll be able to cat the file and listen to what everything's going on. Like think like that. So Nmap, clearly XML, easy to use, been out for decades. Other tools that I have problems with sometimes, like C2s, they use Neo4j interfaces. Java is typically inherently not accessible. When you use like those Neo4j or any kind of those frameworks, it's sometimes yes, sometimes no. Like even, you know, big websites have issues. You know, again, what's challenge number three, sometimes when I run into websites that just have terrible accessibility, you know, again, fortunately I have, you know, a decent amount of vision, but it's one of those things, it's like I have no clue what's going on here, things like that. And you know, so that would be challenge number three, is just understanding what's going on. And then, you know, but, you know, being now an advocate, being a director, manager level person, I get to go back to the client and go, I actually don't understand what your website's doing. Let's do a walkthrough. Or, you know, maybe I'm missing a component. And oftentimes that's what it is. Either there's data that is inherently for that particular vertical or category, and then they come back to me and we work through the problem that way. I think challenge number four would be, again, just, I'm going to combine all of those: lack of documentation, lack of understanding, like what makes something accessible, what makes those things, and kind of trying to explain it to the community, which is why I'm glad I've had opportunities to speak at large conferences, DerbyCon, Circle City, you know, probably upcoming conferences, B-Sides Nova, a couple other places. I've given my Hacking Wild blind talk. So I get to kind of show you some of my difficulties. And so explaining that sometimes causes a little bit more confusion, because a person thinks, oh, maybe if I do it this way, and it either makes it potentially inherently less accessible, depending. But, you know, again, I think the ability for me to be open and have people reach out to me is really the important thing to me. to resolve those challenges.
So I'm sure we'll continue to talk about challenges. I want to flip the question around, especially from a learning perspective.
Yeah.
Did you find that your challenges forced you to learn in a way that actually gave you advantages in any area, or was it all uphill in terms of learning?
That's a really great question. I don't know the answer to that as an individual. I can say, I feel there are concepts because I can close my eyes and really visualize the concept due to some of the things that just like long-term challenges, right? You know, when I'm 16, those are fresh. Now that I'm 20 plus years beyond that, that's less of a fresh challenge. I can tell you that at first, yes, it was difficult to learn because I was definitely a let me see, let me do learner. Well, some things in our industry, when you're trying to listen to a video, it doesn't quite explain how to do these things. So The absence of seeing it makes it a little bit more difficult. So there are challenges there with that. Other things, I feel like I was able to be able to close my eyes and go, did you know this was vulnerable just because of this? And people go, no, that's not true. And then we sit down and we hack it and it turns out it is. And they're like, oh, and I was like, you know, so it's one of those things, like for me as an individual, for sure, there was challenges on certain things. Other times, like, because I can close my eyes and see the concepts rolling by and these frames and lines and dots and graphs and things, because I can kind of put those together. From my systems engineer days where I was responsible for 2,200 plus machines on this government contract, like, yeah, I used to be able to see like, okay, my packet's going to go this way, this way, this way. It's going to go up to this IP address, go through that because there's a defense and depth firewall there. It's going to talk to this thing. You know, that ability to go back and forth with those was pretty interesting on that. So, I think that worked out from that perspective to just learn more.
That's really good insight, honestly, you know, to think of it from your perspective as well too, and your, you know, and how you basically have learned and overcome some of the things you have been through. And it kind of wants me actually to ask this question as well too, like, can you be able to give some insight to, you know, people who have disabilities, you know, and what should they do to be able to overcome some of the challenges that they face? I mean, I know everybody's different. Everybody will go through something different at least, but, you know, to give your own perception or your own insight, I think would be huge, you know, for those that are listening, you know, to this episode right now.
Yeah. So I think for the viewers, if you do have a visual challenge or auditory or any other kind of challenges, I think, you know, again, it's very subjective in this case, right? It's for individualized, but a lot of things that help me conquer stuff is taking the time to try to understand the concept of something. So the theory behind it, right? So the standard, like, this is a thing, this is the way it works. Now, why is it broken? Oh, because of these things. How can I take advantage of the brokenness? Oh, this way. So then going, okay, now if I apply, again, it's now become a methodology for me. And my wife gets so tired of me saying the word methodology, but it becomes a methodology for me to go, okay, I can apply my methodologies, multiple different methodologies, not just one, just depending on what it is, and go, okay, that's the thing that does this, is now I take advantage of it this way. Oh, well, this is a different thing. That's a different methodology. Let me look at it this way. So for everybody else out there, develop your methodology, develop your capability and understanding and the best way to understand it. Now, if you struggle, the best thing to do, and this is like something that I cannot stress, I think it's so weird. I don't think I've ever come across, and TJ, you call me out on it. I don't think I've ever come across as someone who's beyond arrogant. I get a little bit of ego. We have a little bit of fun, but that's a hacker thing. But so when people come to me and ask me these questions, I don't think I've never not answered a question, right? Like, I spend a lot of time going, if you have, you know, if you're listening, even if you're not visually impaired, if you're just having trouble understanding a concept, come to me. I'll tell you my methodology behind it, right? I want to give you that data because, again, this goes back to our very beginning question, like my challenge, like why did I really feel like I got into this? Ultimately, because somebody told me I can't. And I did, and I will, and I will continue to do it. And my, I think that just brings up this, like my best advice is do whatever it takes to empower you to understand something. If that's building a lab, build a lab. If that's breaking a thing with legal permission, break the thing, right? Like go forth and learn, go forth and do whatever it takes to learn it. If there's some person out there telling you tradition is this, tell them go kick rocks, build your own tradition, build your own methodology. Don't let somebody who you think is an educator tell you you can't, because if they're telling you can't, they're not really an educator. If your boss is telling you you can't, they're probably not a very good boss. If someone's telling you that's not a thing and you can see or know that it is, then it is, like, do the thing. And so I think the ultimate methodology, you know, or the ultimate idea of overcoming your and my things was just persistence, pursuance, happiness. And then I became passionate about it. Like, I kind of always wanted to, I always talked about it. I always did things like, that's a cool thing. I can't do that. I'm not that smart. You sit down, you read somebody's insane thing about it. You have no clue what it is. And then you go do it. And that goes not just for my OCP, but like my OSCE, right? I've struggled with that a little bit. And then there we have, like, hey, I was actually able to do a lot of this weird stuff for the OSCE. I'm going to enjoy doing the OSEP too. A lot of offensive security stuff. Because again, I'm a very hands-on learner. I can't do it death by PowerPoint. I can't do it death by video. I can grab a concept I can learn, but if I can't have something to put my code on, my shell into, my ability to do these things, then it's tougher for me. So
doesn't stick. Yeah.
If there's a way for you to learn it, do it. Just do it. Whatever it takes, do it. And, you know, and again, as now as a person passionate about that, come to me. I will attempt to empower you. If there's a monetary cost and you can't do it, the entire point of Blind Hacker and DPS is to either help you find the DPS is Dead Pixel Security. For those of you who don't know, I see TJ smiling. That's the community I run. The entire point of DPS, the offensive security community now, and having community mentors and community things out there, is to see and have multiple people show you a way to do the thing so you can learn it. So that way you don't have to not understand the concept. So you can do that and empower yourself by going to other people. And this might be a dumb question. I hate when people say that, but a lot of people say it. Ask it anyway, because in my opinion, the dumbest question you can ask is the one you don't.
You mentioned gatekeeping before, this concept of gatekeeping in InfoSec. And OffSec is perceived sometimes as doing that via the try harder mantra and the way that our student administrators engage with students. I'll give you an example with that. A student comes and asks a question, and in return, instead of getting an answer right away, they often get a question back, right? And the idea is that they interface with the administrator in a way that it lets them realize by themselves what's going wrong or what they can be doing differently. That gets received differently by different people. But I'm wondering from your perspective, as someone who's coming into it or teaching people coming into it with a little bit of a different outlook or a different level of ability, what do you think about that sort of methodology?
The try harder methodology. At first, when I started my OCP, I was still under the impression that yes, it was this very like hard thing. But what I started to realize, and I said this on other podcasts, I said this on talking with other people and within OffSec and my communities, when somebody tells you and you're in offensive security, you're doing a training and tell you try harder, it's because you're actually on potentially the right path. They're telling you that just look up that one more thing. You're just at this precipice, either overcome it or just take a step back, even breathe, and then come back and review what's going on. And I started to learn try harder also meant enumerate more, because maybe you don't have it. So it's ambiguous, but I do remember getting the questions back. And sometimes it upsets people, and it does. But it's a valuable learning tool, in my opinion. Because I usually try to do this when I teach and when I mentor. I tell people I'm a, you know, one of my, like, if I could put this on the resume and it makes sense, I'd say, you know, hi, I'm Joe Brinkley, you know, director, this and that. And really what, you know, I mentor people, but really what I am is a vivid storyteller. I like to tell people details of a story. And so when somebody asks me a question, this is why I usually end up storytelling, because it's kind of proposing a story is answering a question or asking you a question that you don't realize yet, right? A lot of stories do that. A lot of good writers do that. So when you're a vivid storyteller, I'm like, okay, so now you're, you know, and it's tough to do this through text. So when the student's like, oh, this thing is broken, you're like, no, you're almost there. Have you tried this enumerating more or doing whatever? And then you're like, so the other thing, so as a student, you got to go, okay, let me take this again. Like, I always like using the perspective of a house for a system. It's got vulnerabilities. What are the vulnerabilities? Windows, you know, not the operating system, but you know, windows and doors. And then you've got this, those are open service ports or closed service ports. If the window's closed, what can you do? You can go knock on the port. Now, if a service opens the window, you might be able to take advantage of it. Okay. So again, now we're using vivid imagery. You can close your eyes. You can see what a house looks like. You can see your house. You see hundreds of houses. You go, I knock on a door and somebody answers. Okay. So that's a service. Okay. So the service is doing a thing. How do I exploit it? Well, you ask it really nicely if you can come in, or you punch it, knock it out, and walk in. You know, like, okay. Now, okay, that's an exploit, right? When you're first port scanning to vulnerability scanning, you find a vulnerability. You know, window number 5 has a weak jaw. You can hook him, and that's the vulnerability. Oh, now I've exploited it. I'm in. Now what do you do? Oh, I got to search the other rooms. I don't support B&Es, but, you know, let's talk, you know, I got to search the other rooms. Got to do this. So, okay. But now, okay, the question, hey, I'm having this problem. I can't find the vulnerable service. Did you scan all the ports? Did you look at all the windows in this case? So now the student can go, oh, okay, maybe it's at some other place. Let me look at other ports, maybe other protocols. I don't know, ICMP, UDP, IPX, UPX. You know, there's all these other fun protocols. Like, take a look around. And so the try harder methodology to me started to mean look elsewhere, or look where you're looking a little bit harder. And so now when I see try harder, a lot of people still kind of have this, like, this reflection of this elitism. And I'm like, guys, that's, you know, let's talk about OFSEC, right? In the last few years, you guys have branded the try harder methodology, and I love it, because I'm like, I love methodologies. I'm gonna get a tattoo. It's methodology. Let's do it, you know. And then, so what does that mean now? To me, it means, you know, and again, with my taking OSCE, now OSEP soon, those are things that to me mean I'm going to have to learn something. It's going to be hard to learn it, but guess what? I won't forget it. Ask me what I did on my CEH. Ask me what I did on my Microsoft certs, my CompTIA certs, all these other things. I'm going to tell you, A, B, B, C, D, B, B, and C. I don't remember everything, but I can tell you exactly what I did on my OSCP. I port scanned, I enumerated, I got a low level shell because there was this open McAfee EPO server. At McAfee EPO I found the code on ExploitDB. I went ExploitDB, tried to use it. Oh, it's a bind shell. They have all the firewalls blocking all ports above that. So I either need to go lower, or guess what? Just create a reverse shell. I don't know how to create a reverse shell inside of somebody else's exploit. How to create a reverse shell in this. And then you get back all these articles, people blogging about it, OFSEC talking about it. Like, oh, okay, MSFN and make reverse shell, do a thing, chicken tikkunaya, x86, boom. Now, guess what I do? Every time I get an exploit that doesn't work, I start doing these things. I can tell you that it burned a methodology in me that, there's the word again, that I really love using and exploring and making myself better as a hacker because of that.
You expressed that super well. I don't think I could have done it better.
Appreciate it.
That was some really great insight, honestly. You know, now I think about it, you know, and like you said, you know, you've tried harder, you've gotten to where you are now and what you're doing, you know, with the situations that you're in, you know, you built your own, you know, you've customized your own tools, right, with the watchdog you made, and, you know, with your own methodology too, that you have like your own specific arsenal set, you know, it kind of makes me wonder, you know, about some of the companies that are out there and some of the, you know, tool makers that are out there too, you know, what can they do more to help, you know, members of our community or, you know, future students, right, to be able that have, you know, these disabilities, to be able to help offer, you know, more accessibility options. What do you think on that? What is your perspective on it?
I mean, rule number one is everybody's mission statement in cybersecurity as of 2020, because of the pandemic, and it should have been before that, but because of the pandemic, people working from home, people working remote, you know, we talk about, oh, every company is now essentially an IT company at this point. They don't know it, right? Because they're now supporting remote teleworkers, workers remotely. There's infrastructure, there's things built out. Everybody should be doing this. And you know, with all that, like some of the things that I've reached out to other companies and said, like, hey, this isn't accessible. And I've been told to go kick rocks. And I'm like, okay, well, then I'm not going to use your tool. I'm not going to be purchasing this thing. And so then that's all of a sudden it became a big deal. Like, oh, let's talk and let's do these things. And so thing number one is inclusivity. Include not just inclusive language, but inclusive ideas on your team. When somebody says something like, hey, we should make this accessible, find the availability to make it accessible. Anybody listening to this podcast, reach out to me. Reach out to your nearest blind person. Reach out to your nearest person hard of hearing, hard of whatever, a mobility impaired, you know, somebody who has ADHD does, you know, there's all kinds of science out there that marketing companies have done, like, oh, people with ADHD really like the color blue in the background. So when people put the color blue in the background of a website, people pay attention to it more. You use the color gray and black all the time, maybe people pay a little less attention to it, you know, like, okay, well, that's one little thing. Well, yeah, being visually impaired, I really like contrast. I really like, and it's not always like, by the way, black backgrounds, white text, white backgrounds, black text, like, you know, inverted isn't always better. I like, personally, I like gray and yellow font, like gray backgrounds, yellow font, very much like the color like Discord or like Slack's dark theme. It's not black, it's gray. You know, there's on Twitter, I use the orange text because it pops out a little bit more to me. You know, being the opposite color doesn't always make it better. Having accessibility modes built into your software will make it better. Dark modes will make it better. Not just hackers like it. People with visual impairments typically like looking at black backgrounds because now there's a difference. People who are totally blind, they don't care what it looks like, but use accessibility, use tags, use standard code and formatting features. I could go on and on. It's unfortunately, if I could find somebody to bootstrap a company that I could literally approach other companies, tell them how they fix their thing and then make money off of that, like that's probably a $1 billion thing. And there are companies out there who I see trying to do it. People who with fully sighted, who reach out to people visually impaired and go, hey, can you explain to me if this product works for you? You know, this website works for you. You know, one of the, you know, I've talked to TJ about this a few times, talked to a few other people out there. The worst site for accessibilities is usually the bigger sites. Amazon, go to Amazon and type in a green shorts. The first page probably is going to have all green shorts. Maybe you're not going to like the sound or description of them if you're totally blind. By the time you get to the second page, it's going to say green in the title. But when you click on that page, it's going to be army. It's going to be camo. It's going to be swirly, tie-dye. Like, they don't say tie-dye green shorts. They don't say army green shorts. Sometimes they do. But the descriptors and things don't work. So when you use pictures, if you're using a lot of graphical stuff, just make it accessible. I do like, you know, Tenable's initial interface was not great when they had that thick client on your computer. Then they went to the HTML browser, much better. A lot of C2s, CLI or HTML5, love it. Stick with HTML5. It's mostly accessible. Cobalt Strike, I don't mean to pick on, you know, Munch and all those guys, but it was not that great initially. It's probably not going to get much better, but we'll see where it goes in the future. But like other things, well, guess what though? It was CLI capable, so I can run CLI. I can do a lot of that stuff. Again, Bloodhound, not accessible initially. But now building the tool so it can have XML, having output, have a parser built, document how to build a parser, document your XML structure. That makes it so I don't have to go read XML and figure out your parsing structure. APIs, if you're not going to build it accessible, give me an API that can give me the same output. So again, I can document it and parse it. It's not difficult, but it's not easy. It takes a little bit of effort. And with that little bit of effort, we're going to be able to do some amazing things, like get more people who have disabilities who might be not able to be as independent, be independent. Independence is a huge thing. I mean, if you've ever lost your ability to be independent for even a short period of time, you can't drive because you broke a leg, you can't do something because, you know, it's a temporary setback, or if it's long-term, you know that, like, as a person, it's not inclusive, it's debilitating, it feels bad, man. And just by adding a little bit of inclusivity text to your world, adding a little bit of effort to your software, your product, your tools, you can really bring a change to someone's life, the capability, the ability for them to be independent, the ability for them to do a job, be passionate, be another me, if you want those, hopefully, and do some cool things.
You mentioned Cali before, with respect to inclusivity. What does Cali do specifically for that? And is there anything that we can relay back to the Cali guys to maybe add improvements there?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a benefit now being kind of a big community member with some followers and then working with Cali and TJ and the team. One of the cool things that I remember doing is I went to, I don't remember which conference it was, Johnny Long was there. He's like, they were auctioning off a Cali, like, netbook or Chromebook or something. It was small, but I was like, you know, it's okay. Visually probably not great. I could plug in a set of headphones, listen to it, but it was small but powerful. And I remember going, hey, is there any accessibility options? And this was before the use of XFCE the way it is now. This was early, like, just, oh yeah, we took Cali and threw vanilla XFCE on it, or the cut up XFCE. And I was like, the cut up one's not great. But I looked into it, and when they started talking about that they wanted to change, I remember going to the forum and saying, guys, it should really, there was like a voter poll or something. I was like, XFCE, and here's partially why. And I don't know if, they even took it into consideration, but ultimately it won. And then I went to XFCE and was like, so you guys have integrated with these tools, accessibility tools in the past. Can you kind of make it a little bit better? And it actually drove a change at the XFCE forums, and they started making it way easier to access, because before it's kind of buried. And now it's literally, you can go accessibility. It pops up, it's right there. And the first thing that you can do is hit a couple keyboard buttons, boom, turn it off. Even if you don't know it, you can hit a couple keyboard buttons and accidentally turn it on. And driving that kind of change with Cali was great. One of the things that the only thing I can suggest to the team is, you know, keep the way it is. I like the fact that they don't have a lot of GUI based tools. They keep it CLI. That's just, you know, that's kind of the hacker way. Oh yeah, CLI nerds or GUI nerds. And you're like, who cares, man? If somebody's using a product, that's cool. And again, this goes to the vendors and tool writers. Keep it CLI. If you do throw a GUI, make it so I can interact with it via CLI. One of my favorite tools is Sparta / Legion now. It's a solid scanning tool. It comes up with a lot of data. It's only partially accessible though. So what you have to do is file, save as, save out the output, and then navigate to the output, and then you get more of the output just because of the way the Java window loads it. It gets a little weird. And I don't think that's something they can fix, because again, that's a Java programming, the GUI thing. But like, you know, again, keeping the tool CLI, solid start, keeping Orca updated, keeping the accessibility options there. I love that. What version was it, TJ? Was it the 2020.1 or 2019.4? automatically had, because I, at that point I started having a lot more influence with the Kali community, high contrast mode was there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they integrated that or that was an XFCE thing, but I was like, I accidentally hit a couple of key combinations and I was like, well, my screen blew up and it's different colors. What did I do? And I was like, this is actually great. I'm going to use this for a little while. So I was using it on a little 15.6 inch laptop and I was like, this is great. you know, things for OFSEC, you know, I came and talked with you guys about it, mm-hmm. About like making the training a little bit more inclusive and the you know, keeping the PowerPoints generated, the PDFs and PowerPoint, or not the PowerPoints, but the PowerPoints generated the way you keep them, because other major training vendors they actually like scan or book or like scan something else and it glosses over images. And when you put an image in the middle of the page and then the text is reading it, it might jump a whole section because that's not actual text in its mind. The OCR capability of these things is getting better, but leaving it raw text is a little better. I talked, you know, when you develop training, some of the other things that like I've come up with kind of a checklist now, like using headings and stuff. So if I open it up in a PDF on the left side, there's the headings section. So yep. I can see that. That's like, oh, that's hugely accessible. But like when I write a report for, and I print it out in Word, or if I do stuff, I have to use that because navigating 700 pages in some of these reports I write, like, yeah, not going to happen. Now that I'm a manager and I got to read these things, like, that section's not important to me. That section's not important to me. This thing is important to me. You know, I get to the section, I hit play, I listen to it in the background and go, okay, that made sense, sir. What the heck is a B better block? And I go back up and I'm like, oh, somebody accidentally mashed the keyboard. Let's just delete that. And just again, that's for training, that's inclusive for Kali, keeping it that way. The one thing that you know, being a guy who uses it a lot, sometimes the VMware images get a little stucky, but that could also be my hardware. It could be a number of things, like trying to get a readout or a screen zoom. But again, you know, when I'm VMing it, I'm using it on usually a Windows machine or Ubuntu machine, and that zoom kind of takes over. But yeah, on little devices, accessibility, keeping those key combinations in there, just being aware of when you add tools, some of the tools might not be accessible. And, you know, we can easily turn around and create a list of accessible and non-accessible tools. That's something easy we could do because I can just literally go through, hey, most of these are CLI and the way most of them read out, they work. And boom, now you have a list of accessible tools and not accessible tools. And what can we do with that? Well, if it's a tool that's used a lot that's not accessible, maybe we build it accessible, or we contact the vendor or the tool writer and go, how much effort would it take for you to do a thing?
So I got one more question before we have to go ahead and do our final salute for this episode. But, yeah. You know, for tool vendors, do you see, you know, like a large amount of people with disabilities, you know, requesting for these accessibility options? I mean, I don't know really from my perspective, at least seeing tool-wise, you know, I don't really see that as much. But if there's a way that I could be able to help push, or even members of the community help try to push that, you know, to help others in this world that have these disabilities, you know, what is your perspective on that? Or at least trying to get, you know, your ideas of what we could do better, you know, in this world?
I mean, I loop it back all the way around from start to finish. Don't tell people they can't do it. If people are having issues with the tool, try to help them, especially if you're a vendor. Like, you could lose sales that way. Like, and to lose a sale, even if it's one person, over something dumb like that, it's kind of silly. Like, it can't be that hard. Like, if, you know, I get it, you can't release it today, but put it on your sprint, your runs, your development life cycle, that eventually you need to include accessibility. Because if not, you're losing out on sales. Who cares if they're not, you know, buying it, or they're threatening to not buy it now, but in the future, you know, as you know, those of us who stare at screens all the time, you know, your glasses get thicker, they get a little, your prescription gets worse, you know, things like that. It's like, yeah, just add a little bit of accessibility, larger font, great. Making sure it's readable, great. And it's not hard to get like 508 checks on these things. So vendors, highly encourage them to do it. Community members, if you think you wrote a tool and it's not accessible, reach out. If you don't think your blog's accessible, reach out to me. Reach out to anybody. Go 5 tools I use on a daily basis: Pocket, the Reader, Natural Reader, the built-in screen reader on Windows, the built-in Dragon for voice to text, and then sometimes the screen reader. I use the one built into Windows, or Orca built into Kali or Linux. And if you don't think it's accessible, use that. And I'm going to tell you now, something you're going to discover is when you hit go on Orca or the screen reader or a natural reader, if it's a website or a blog and you're seeing it read it, or it's not off tilted, it shows you what words it's reading and how it's moving. If that starts to come off to screwy as you, as a person with vision looking at this thing happen, I'm going to tell you, it's going to be screwy for someone who's blind, visually impaired, mobile impaired, making buttons that are tiny and move, or things like don't do that. Make things static, make things easier to understand, document. I said that a lot in my Hacking While Blind talk: document. Just, if you're not going to do it, tell me how I can.
It's very good points right there, and I really do appreciate that. Well, Blind, thank you for being on. I really do appreciate you taking the time out of your day to actually chat with us and Harbinger. I'm glad that you were able to be on today as well, being able to actually ask some questions too. But more importantly as well too, I also want to thank the listeners that was taking the time to listen to this episode. We hope you guys enjoyed it and were able to gain some value for it. But be sure to check out Offense Security's website for more information on these topics and courses by going to offensive-security.com.